Today's Taisho will be on case 32 in the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 32 is entitled Zhou Jouza Stands Still. Engo's introduction. Once the delusive way of thinking is cut off, a thousand eyes are suddenly opened. One word blocking the stream of thought, and all Nen actions are controlled. If there is anyone who would undergo the experience of dying the same death, is there anyone here who would undergo the experience of dying the same death and living the same life as the Buddha? Truth is manifest everywhere. If you do not see it, here is an ancient example. See the following. Main subject. Zhou Jouza asked Rinzai, what is the essence of Buddhism? Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Zhou Jouza stood still. A monk standing by said, Zhou Jouza, why don't you bow? When Zhou Jouza bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. Secho's verse, inheriting the spirit of Danse, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Kaisan, letting the yellow river run through. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. This is a really wonderful koan. Let me read it one more time. Zhou Jouza, or let me say that Zhou Jouza in this koan was a monk who was like a senior monk in the temple. So Jouza is his Dharma name, and Zhou is like his job. He's like a senior monk who's in charge, has certain duties in the temple. And so this involves somebody who's been practicing for a long time and has not wakened up. He's a respected person in the Sangha, in the community. And he's been coming to SIDS, he's been doing his practice diligently, but he hasn't awakened. After many years, like 20, 25 years. Zhou Jouza asked Rinzai, what is the essence of Buddhism? Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Zhou Jouza stood still. A monk standing by said, Zhou Jouza, why don't you bow? When Zhou Jouza bowed, he suddenly became enlightened. So if you think about it, this is about a senior monk who had been practicing for a long time, like decades, and still hadn't awakened. So his question to Rinzai isn't an academic question. It's not a question that he's asking lightly. He's asking it maybe almost like in desperation or in a sense of like hopelessness. He's been practicing for a long time, but he hasn't had the payoff, right? When Americans, when Genki Roshi, my late beloved first teacher, came from Japan, lots of people went to sit with him. So we would have sits a little bit like our Thursday night sits on Wednesday night at the University of Washington. Webb Roshi, who was then Webb Sensei, had access to a museum space in the art building at the University of Washington. And we would go a little earlier than the sit would start at 7, just like here. And some of us would get there around 6:30, and we would very carefully move away some of the displays in the art museum, which were on wheels. And we would wheel them out of the way, and then we would take a big dust mop and go up and down the floor. And then our zabutons were kept in a cabinet in the museum. They were nice enough to let us leave our stuff there. And we would spread them out. And when Genki Roshi first came to Seattle, on a Wednesday night, we would get 50 people. And it was just, there was like no room for all the people. This was like the 70s, right? So America was a very different place then. People had a lot of optimism about the future. Especially young people, and in Seattle at that time, it was just filled with young people. I mean, probably the average age in Seattle was about 28. It just seemed that everybody you saw on the street was under 40. And there was just this tremendous energy in the city. It was like a young person's city. And people had tremendous optimism. There was a musical group called Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And they were hugely popular. And on college campuses, you could walk by a dorm and it would be likely you would hear Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young playing in somebody's dorm room. And one of the lines is, famous lines of one of their songs is, "We can change the world, rearrange the world." See, this was really the spirit. So, when Genki Roshi first arrived, people were very excited by the prospect of a real-life Zen master from Japan, as I was. I was incredibly excited. And people came to sit with him. At first there would be like 50 people, and then I was a member of Genki Roshi's group for a long time, at first when we would have a sesshin, there might be 50 people at the sesshin. But gradually people began to realize that Zen practice is a lot of work. It takes a great deal of commitment and determination. And so, a certain number of people began to peel away, because they realized, this is not quite what I was bargaining for. And so the sits would get a little smaller on Wednesday night at the university, and also the number of people attending sesshin would get a little smaller too. People didn't really understand meditation. They understood meditation as there was a man who made a huge amount of money running a sort of meditation seminars. It was called Earhart Seminar Training, EST. And people would go to these seminars, and at the end of the seminar, it would be like a 5-day seminar. You would be told, well, that you're awake. And people would leave those seminars very happy that they had achieved enlightenment. But I think people in our group initially, in our Sangha, came thinking it would be like that, like a couple sesshins and I should be there. And when it didn't turn out to be that way, I think some people got discouraged, you know, or they just lost interest in something that required so much of a commitment. What eventually happened to many people in the group is, you know, there was a core of people who practiced for like 10 years. And Genki Roshi came in 77, and there was really like, or 70, 75, I guess it was. And then, you know, by 85, there were people who had been going to sits regularly, going to sesshins as often as they could. And they had practiced for 10 years, and I think many of them reached a crisis point, you know, because they were thinking, okay, I've given this a lot of time and attention. I've been practicing for 10 years. 10 years! And I haven't had my great awakening experience. And they were not bitter or angry so much as they were a little surprised, you know. And that is a kind of like a point in somebody's practice where they begin to wonder why they're doing this, right? Joe Joza is a little bit like that kind of a person, you know. Now, you know, in the context of like Chinese Buddhism, it's very different. You know, people understand the Great Way as a lifetime commitment, you know. In Asian countries, people understand that Buddhas are very rare. You know, Buddhas happen like once in Buddhism, it said once in a world age. In other words, basically a very long period of time before Buddha appears. And deeply enlightened people too. It takes a long time for such people to appear. In the context of Chinese Buddhism, people don't have the same sort of like timetable, right? You know, people are making what they understand to be a lifetime commitment. You could say like the journey is the practice, right? It's the, you know, we think of enlightenment as a goal-directed practice, and that's good in a way, right? The goal of Zen practice is enlightenment. We think of Zen as a goal-directed practice, and the end point is enlightenment. We have a way of thinking about this as like everything we're doing should be getting us there, and of course, the faster the better, right? And people in East Asia don't have the same understanding. They understand that that the goal is really not enlightenment, actually. The goal is becoming a Buddha, and Buddhahood is a huge enterprise that takes many lifetimes. See, so the practice is the goal in a certain way. The practice is the goal. See, so when people sign up to become a monk or a nun in Taiwan or mainland China or Japan, they're not expecting to be there for a few years and then to check out and take up another career. It's like this is a lifetime enterprise, right? They have a different mentality. Nevertheless, you know, somebody like Joe Joza was probably wondering, you know, why after 20 years of practice, no enlightenment. No enlightenment. You know, he's been getting up, you know, in traditional Chinese temples, people actually get up around like 3, you know. They get up, at least before the Cultural Revolution, in Chinese temples, people used to get up at like 3 in the morning, and they would do some preliminary zazen. And then they would recite sutras at dawn, and actually it was possible for them to go back to their rooms and take like a little nap. And then there'd be some more zazen, and then there would be breakfast. And sort of sesshin schedule was somewhat like their daily schedule, except that they had work responsibilities in the temple during the day. So like after like the 10 o'clock sit, they would have some work responsibilities, they'd eat lunch, and then they'd have some work responsibilities in the afternoon, and then you'd have an afternoon sutra recitation, meditation, dinner, and then meditation until lights out around 9. So Jojo Za had been, you know, doing this for 20 years. And he's wondering, you know, when am I going to wake up, you know? And even though in a Chinese, the context of Chinese Buddhism, people have a different set of expectations, actually, if you look at stories about Zen teachers, there are definitely many stories about Zen teachers who put in about 20 years and began to wonder, what's this all about? You know, what am I doing here? And there are many stories. You know, there's a story about one Zen teacher monk who had been in the temple for 20-some years, and he was so frustrated that he left. He quit. He said to the abbot of the temple, "I'm leaving. That's it. You know, I've given this 20-25 years of my life." And then he was living in a little hut, and he was raking gravel, and a piece of gravel hit a dried stalk of bamboo. And when he heard that hit, the story says he had his great awakening experience. Jojo Za is a person like that. He's been a faithful practitioner of the Great Way for 20 years, let's say, and no enlightenment. And so when he talks to Master Rinzai, he's not really asking an idle question or an academic question. He's saying, you know, what is this all about? What's the essence of this? And then, you know, Rinzai does something kind of unexpected. He grabs Jojo Za, slaps him, and shoves him back. And Jojo Za is just frozen. Now, you know, this experience of being frozen or caught or trapped or unable to move is something nobody likes. Nobody likes. I belong to that generation that went to college when Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young used to sing, we can change the world, we can rearrange the world. We can change the world, rearrange the world. You know, and tremendous optimism. So all of those people who went to college in the 1970s are now living in the age of Trump, right? And every day, you know, people of my generation, open the newspaper and, Mr. Trump is doing something that is upsetting, you know. So he's rolling back environmental standards, right? And he wants to open some of the national forests and national parks up to development. As somebody who spent a lot of time hiking in the national parks and national forests, I consider them like a priceless treasure. So, you know, selling off some of this land so that people can put a McDonald's on it is heartbreaking to me, very upsetting. And then, you know, the next day we'll read that Mr. Trump is destroying the healthcare system, you know. My wife's family are all artists, you know, and they're really great artists, but they are not business people, you know. So, you know, they've made many sacrifices to be artists. They live very, you know, challenging lives because they have devoted themselves to their art. So, you know, my sister-in-law is a good example of somebody who is like I think really like a very gifted painter. And her work is really moving and beautiful. And she can sell, you know, she can sell her work. But she's not at the level where, you know, if she sold 5 paintings, she would have, you know, a lot of money. So, you know, she might do some paintings that are really beautiful, and out of 5, she might sell 1, right, or 2. And if she has a good year, she might sell 3. But she's still, you know, even if she does that, you know, the paintings take her a long time to do, and, you know, she still doesn't make a decent, what you would say is a average middle-class living at all, you know. And so, you know, she herself is dependent on Obamacare. You know, and so are most of the people in my wife's family. The Obamacare has actually worked out for them very well. So, you know, when Mr. Obama is now going to undo Obamacare, it really, I find it very upsetting because, you know, I know it's going to hurt people I love. You know, and I, even people I don't know, you know, I know many people are desperately counting on these benefits being available to them. You know, if you I have a wonderful health plan. You know, I'm a state of New Jersey employee. So, you know, if I fall and break my arm or something, or if I have a tumor in my ear, as a friend of mine just developed, you know, he can go to the doctor, and there's a $15 copay, right? And that's it. And then, you know, leave it to us. And meanwhile, there are people who are just have serious health problems, and they're desperate, and Mr. Trump is eliminating that. You know, so I myself have many friends. When I was in graduate school, I had a lot of friends who were Iranians, Persians. I really liked my Iranian friends. They were really wonderful people. The idea that we might be going to war with Iran is really upsetting to me, very worrying. So, you know, anyway, I grew up believing we can change the world, rearrange the world. And in my wildest dreams, I never thought we would end up here. And I opened the newspaper Mr. Trump is doing. I think Mr. Trump is like a Batman villain, right? You know, he does this bad thing and then this bad thing. And while you're still trying to recover from that bad thing, he's on to another bad thing. And it's possible to have a tremendous sense of, like, helplessness. Helplessness. You know, we who believed we could change the world are now opening our newspapers and feeling helpless, you know, as things get worse. And of course, we don't have to stay helpless. I mean, I just renewed my membership to the Natural Resources Defense Council, environmental organization, and I belong to Environmental Defense Fund, and I support a number of organizations, and I was so upset that I joined another one, you know, and sent them a check, you know. So, you know, and I do many other things, trying to help people and be helpful and useful. But this experience of being helpless or being trapped is a common human experience. You know, it's a common human experience. And in a way, you know, it's almost an inescapable human experience, even though we don't like to think about it. You know, we like to think that, you know, we're action people. You know, if something's wrong, we fix it. If something's broken, we repair it. You know, if something's wrong, when we see an injustice, we right it. You know, and those are, you should do that whenever you have the chance. But very often in life, you know, on the big level, on the macro level, and on the little level, you know, it's possible to feel really, really helpless, really helpless. You know, or trapped. trapped, right? Helplessness, trapped, that feeling of being unable to make happen what you want to have happen. See, being unable to make happen. In Jojo Za's case, it's enlightenment. You know, he wants to make happen enlightenment. He's been practicing for 20 years. He's been a faithful student of the Dharma, no enlightenment. And in your case, it might be something else. Maybe you've written a novel. You know, I have a friend of mine who's a science writer, and he publishes articles, but he's written this wonderful book. And he's probably spent 6 years on this book, and he can't find a book agent. And you know, imagine, you know, every spare moment of your life, you're writing this book, and you're pouring your heart into it. And I've read chapters of it. It's great. I don't know why he can't find an agent. But he can't find an agent. And he publishes, articles in environmental journals. And he actually goes to these conferences, and everybody knows who he is. His name is Jeff. Jeff is like known, he's respected, he has a PhD in physics, you know, but he can't get this book published. And, you know, it hasn't eaten him up, but it definitely bothers him that he's wanted this to happen and it hasn't happened. It's something he can't make happen. That feeling, I want this to happen, but I can't make it happen. We all know that feeling. Nobody likes the feeling of being trapped in that way. Nobody likes that, right? It's a horrible feeling. I have a friend of mine, Mark Wasserman, who's the chairman of the history, was the chairman of the history department here at Rutgers. And I saw Mark one day and I said, "Mark, how's it going?" And he said, "Oh, pretty good. But my grandson has leukemia." And his grandson is just like a little kid, like, I don't know, 5, something like that. He has a child, you know, there's a special, little children can get leukemia, believe it or not. And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that," you know, and he said, "Yeah," and he said, "The thing is," you know, he said, "there's been so much progress on medical research that childhood leukemia is now really easy to deal with, except in the case of what my grandson has." He said, "This is like a particular kind, and they don't know what to do about it." And, you know, my friend is—he's such a good human being, and you know, and he didn't start crying or something. He was brave, and he was, you know, hopeful, right? But it must be an awful—it's an awful feeling to go through that. I know that, you know, my own brother had cancer and died of cancer, and that was a terrible feeling. You know, I mean, I know that my sister, you know, and my sister-in-law, you know, they got frustrated. You know, they wanted to go into the doctor and just say, "God damn it, you know, what do you have to do to get this guy back on his feet?" You know, and there was nothing to do. Nothing to do. Nobody likes that feeling. You know, one of my second teacher's teachers was a man named Shinichi Hisamatsu. And Shinichi Hisamatsu is considered in Japan to be like a very well-respected Buddhist philosopher. And Hisamatsu was a deeply awakened person. He had trained in Zen temples. But he made his living as a professor of philosophy. And he trained people in Zazen, you know, in Chan, in Zen. But he also wrote on philosophy. And Hisamatsu Roshi was caught in Japan during the period that was that saw the rise of Japanese militarism. So, you know, in the 20s and 30s, Japan sort of slipped into fascism and military aggression, just like Germany in the same period, and hopefully we're not going in that same direction. I hope we aren't. But Hisamatsu was a very sensitive and intelligent person with a great heart of compassion. And he saw his country slipping into evil ways, right? You know, evil ways. And he was very, he did his best to respond to this. But, you know, he was kind of sidelined, you know, during the war years. And after the war, he talked about this experience. And he said, you know, what can you do? What can you do when there's nothing you can do? What do you do when there's nothing you can do? You know, that was actually one of, it was a koan he created himself. And it's actually like a really wonderful koan. You know, we want to believe that when things are bad, we can do something to fix it. And sometimes we can, and we should, you know. So, you know, definitely next election, whatever you do, don't vote for Trump, you know, whoever he's running against, you know, vote for the other guy or the other woman, whoever it might be. And, you know, and let's hope we have a better outcome. You know, in your local elections, you can vote in your local elections. You can sign petitions. You can sign up for the Natural Resources Defense Fund. You can contribute to them. You know, those are all good, noble things. If you have the time, you can demonstrate, you know. But you know, it's unlikely to stop Mr. Trump. So, you know, we're all in this situation where you say, what do you do when there's nothing you can do? When there's nothing, you're doing your best, but it's not producing the result you want. And nobody likes to be in that position. It's a position that we dislike intensely, but it's a universal human situation, right? It's a universal situation. You know, my friend Mark, you know, he's not the only one who has a grandchild who has this kind of leukemia or something like it. You know, I'm sure that if Mark could, if there was some kind of a genie and he said to Mark, I'll cut off your arm, would you cut off your arm to save your grandson? There's no question he'd chop it right off, you know. And if somebody said, would you die to save your grandson? I'm sure Mark would do it. I'm sure he'd say, kill me now, please, you know. But, you know, there's no genie to make the deal with. So you know, this experience of being trapped is so terrible, or can be so terrible, so unpleasant. You know, we want to be able to make the thing we want to happen, we can't make happen. You know, and this is a universal human experience. And for people of my generation especially, you know, if you had asked me when I was 22 years old, do you think the world is going to look like this? I would have laughed. I would have said, there's no way. That's never going to happen, you know. We'll have an environment, you know, we'll have a, there was a book I liked called Ecotopia. It was about how we were going to green our society. There'd be no more cars. We'd have electric cars, solar power. We would have, everybody would have medical, free medical. This was the world we were sure we were heading into. And it's almost like a movie, you know, like Batman, like the Joker has taken over the city and he's done everything wrong, you know. So for Jojo-za, it's the same thing, you know. He's given his life to something and it's not paying out, not paying off. And he doesn't know what to do. He's out of ideas. So he goes to Rinzai and he says, you know, what is the essence of Buddhism? And Rinzai does something unexpected. He slaps him and pushes him back. And Jojo-za, his mind is frozen. So, you know, I should say this is a little bit shocking, but, you know, Rinzai, Linji, was a really amazing teacher in Tang Dynasty China. He left a huge impact on Chinese people. And in fact, you know, if you went to China before the Cultural Revolution, if you went to any Chan temple, the people there would say, "We're Rinzai, we follow Rinzai Linji's Zen, Linji Chan." His impact was so enormous. And what Linji made him so important, Rinzai, so important, was his teaching of the person of no rank. You know, he said that inside you is this this luminous, enlightened mind, right? And, you know, we humans have a tendency to imagine Buddha or enlightenment as something outside of ourselves, right? Something outside of ourselves, maybe in heaven or in another dimension. You know, we give it names like Shiva or Rama or God or Allah, right? You know, basically in China especially, people felt very unvalued by their society. You know, you had elite leadership that were very cultured, and the average person felt really unworthy, really, and people were encouraged to think of themselves as unworthy. So, you know, Rinzai came along and he said, you know, inside you, you know, he said basically, inside you, don't look to heaven for God, don't look to heaven for Allah, don't invoke Shiva or Ram. You know, what you're looking for is inside yourself. And this had like a revolutionary impact on Chinese people. This was like an amazing, amazing teaching that revolutionized Buddhism in China. But Rinzai was also known for really abrupt or direct tactics. So, you know, Rinzai was often, he would just shout in the Zendo, you know, he would shout, he would push people, he might slap you. Now, I really don't think people should use these techniques in the modern Western world. I don't think they work very well. It just looks like aggression, you know. But what Rinzai was trying to say was, look, you know, don't worry about being polite. You know, Chinese culture put a lot of emphasis on ritual, politeness, etiquette, and Rinzai said, you know, basically, screw all of that. You know, just be natural. Act with energy from your natural place of being awake. See. And so, you know, he would do these things that were kind of shocking, like slapping people or pushing them. And in this koan, we're sort of seeing the typical Rinzai response, you know, where he actually just, and again, I don't think people should do this. I would not, if you run into a Zen teacher who slaps people or yells at them, leave that teacher. Don't stay with that teacher. Unlikely that that teacher is a Rinzai. Probably not. Just a bully, probably. But Rinzai was person of incredibly deep compassion, and that's why people trusted him, right? They knew him and trusted him. So anyway, Rinzai slaps Joe, and he is totally frozen. You know, he is absolutely unable to step forward or step back. He's unable to speak. He's unable to move, right? And this is like the absolute place of being frozen, or like Shinichi Hisamatsu said, you know, what do you do when there's nothing you can do? When there's nothing you can do? You know, you could say that Zen training is all about answering this question. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, if we're really concentrating, we enter deep samadhi, ding, right? And when we're in deep samadhi, we are, you could say, drop the body, right? You know, when you sit on the cushion and you straighten your back and you watch your breath, after a while, classical Zen texts call this dropping the body, right? It's like you are no longer in your body fully, or your body is just on the margins of your awareness. You know, it's probably the case if your legs are getting tired that you feel your legs, but you probably don't feel much of your body other than your legs and maybe your hands, a little bit of your face. And you're in this state of sort of like disembodiment almost, right? And then we also enter Ushin. We enter empty mind. So you're in this deep samadhi state, which is somewhat disembodied. You've dropped the body. And you're now entering this blankness, right? In this state, everything has disappeared, at least for intervals. You know, a normal human being is in this state a little bit during a half-hour sit, and then out of it, and then in it, and out of it. But every once in a while, you know, everything lines up, and you're very deeply in this samadhi, and then you enter this emptiness. And, you know, in this state, this is like the limits of yourself, right? This is the limits of yourself. This is the limits of your ability to act, the limits of your ability to change anything around you. In this state, it's like very close to like non-existence, yeah, we could say. If you stay in that condition for a long time, you know, you begin to notice something. You know, typically what happens to people is that, you know, you might, if you're really sitting deeply and you do sit down on the mat and you're straight in your back and you're watching your breath and you enter samadhi and then you enter this blankness, even for a little while, you know, it's likely that when you get off the cushion and you walk away, you feel great or you feel better than you did. You know, and you go outside maybe and you see some flowers and you look at the flowers and your whole mind becomes the flowers. You know, when we're in this state, we're very open and receptive and everything becomes lively. Everything becomes alive. Well, you know, one way to think about what is happening to us is that you could say we're entering a bigger life. Bigger life. You know, so the classical way of putting it in Japanese Zen is to say when we die on the cushion, you know, we come alive as the universe, you could say. As the 10,000 things. You know, when we are absolutely unable to do anything, absolutely reach that point of zero, motionless zeroness, you know, that's something we dread, but when we get into that state and we stay there, it's like we shift perspective and we become part of a bigger life, a bigger life. The whole world becomes like our body. The whole world becomes our body. See, and this is this will happen. If it hasn't happened to you, it will happen to you. Apparently, it had never happened to Jojo Za after 20 years of practice. If you do a lot of zazen, this will happen to you. You get into a place where literally you don't have to move. Because you're sort of like dropping the body, and then you enter Ushin, you enter that emptiness. And if you stay there long enough, you know, you begin to feel energy. There's like this energy in there. And it doesn't make any sense, right? Because there's nothing there. But if you stay in that state, you begin to feel this pulsing energy, life energy. And then, you know, if you get off the cushion and you walk outside, everything is so alive. Everything becomes so alive. And you can keep deepening this experience again and again. The world becomes your body. You know, the world becomes your body. And everything around you becomes alive. It's like, you know, when we're in a place where we can't do anything, we feel totally trapped. Nobody likes that place, but that's an opportunity to enter the bigger life, enter this bigger life. And in a way, unless you're in that place, unless you're really totally trapped and unable to do anything, you can't enter that bigger life. You know, the art of Zen is sort of like the art of going to that place where you're absolutely frozen and then shifting gears, shifting your framework, dropping the body and becoming one with the 10,000 things. I think I quoted this last time, but, you know, Dogen said to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things. Yeah, another way to put it is, you know, when you're absolutely trapped, when there's nothing you can do in your small self, you have to become, we say in Zen, your big self. Or your big self. The whole world becomes your body. And this is liberation. You know, this is a most amazing state of freedom and spontaneity and connectedness. It's like eternal life. You know, and so, you know, Jojo Za hasn't discovered any of this. He's been practicing Zazen, but he hasn't gone to that place where you drop the body and you enter Ushin. And he hasn't felt that energy yet, and he hasn't experienced the world as his body. But Rinzai sees this, and this is why Rinzai acts so energetically. You know, Jojo Sa's been sitting on the cushion, maybe he's been thinking, maybe he's just been cultivating mental quietude. Right? He's just been doing mindfulness meditation. So he's just focusing on the present moment, focusing on the present, nothing's happening. So Rinzai smacks him, and his mind goes completely blank. And a monk says, Jojo Za, why don't you bow? But it's not Jojo Za who bows. It's his big self that bows. In other words, he acts out of that place of emptiness from that limitless energy. And then he realizes who he really is. Not the small self, the big self. See? Jojo Za asked Rinzai, what is the essence of Buddhism? Rinzai, getting up from his seat, seized him, slapped him, and pushed him away. Jojo Za stood still. He entered deep samadhi, and then Ushin, empty mind, Mushin. A monk standing by said, Jojo Za, why don't you bow? And that energy bowed, right? When Jojo Za bowed, he became enlightened. He experienced the world as his body. Setchel's verse. inheriting the spirit of Danse, how could he be gentle and quiet? Not difficult for Kyore to lift his hands and split Mount Kasan, letting the yellow river run through. You know, when you're in your small self, in the I, in the me, all the time you feel trapped, you feel boxed in, you feel helpless. You will as long as you're in your small self. You know, the small self has its victories, but, you know, that's the way of living in the small self, is to be blocked, right? But when you can enter your big self, when you can drop the body, enter a machine, and become your big self, it's like you can lift your hands and split the Rocky Mountains to let the Mississippi River run through. Of course, the Mississippi River doesn't run through the Rocky Mountains, but you see what I'm getting at.